Hi, everybody, and welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us on this Tuesday afternoon. Today, we're going to have a conversation with two gentlemen who are well-known activists for racial equality. Ralph Moore recently stepped down as program manager at Restoration Gardens. That's a residence for formerly homeless youth. DeRay McKesson is active in the Black Lives Matter movement. He's the interim chief human capital officer in the Baltimore City Public School System and the co-founder of Campaign Zero, which focuses on police reform. So we're going to talk about the connection between the Black Lives Matter movement, which prides itself on being a broad movement that's not led by any one particular person, and the civil rights movement of the 1960s, which was dominated by the charismatic leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Black Lives Matter seemed to spring up spontaneously and out of nowhere following the deaths of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown in Florida and Missouri. But although the problems that animate the movement, particularly police misconduct and brutality, were most certainly around during the 1960s, Dr. King and the leaders of groups like the Southern Christian Leadership Conference or the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee did not focus their efforts on the police. They worked for federal legislation like the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. So what is the lineage between the movement of the 1960s and the movement of today? Strategically, philosophically, and emotionally, how much do they have in common? Ralph Moore and DeRay McKesson will be speaking about this tomorrow night at an event at St. Bartholomew's Church on Edmondson Avenue in West Baltimore, and they join me today here in Studio A. It's good to see both of you. Thanks for coming in.
It's good to be here.
So, Ralph, let's start with you. Just give us a little background about your life in activism. This started for you as a young kid.
Well, I guess I was always around persons who were involved, and they kind of dragged me in, and I kind of started getting in their way, too. You know, the likes of, I had a couple of mentors, Sampson Green and Walter P. Carter, who were from the civil rights movement, both from the South, lived here, went to the Eastern Shore and other places to picket and demonstrate and integrate facilities in very risky ventures. And I learned at home how to do service. I learned at school with the Oblate Sisters of Providence, which is an order of African-American nuns, about service, and I watched them feed hungry people. And then I went to a Jesuit high school up in Towson, took three buses to get there from my home in Sandtown, Winchester. And the Jesuits say that the end point of a quality education is service to others. That was supposed to be the point. Graduated there, and then while I was in college, I worked with a very active chaplain there, a fellow named Dr. Chester Wickwire, God bless him, who was the only white man to head up the Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance, which was an organization of black preachers in town. But I kept getting involved. I guess one of my signature first endeavors was with three friends of mine, we decided to paint statues, the statues in our local church, black. You know, I'm sitting in church and I'm wondering why is it that all the figurines in here are white and we're in a black congregation. But there were picket lines and picket signs, as the song goes. We working with the folks who started St. Ambrose Housing Aid Center, we picketed in front of and I was a kid again in high school and college, in front of a local Blockbuster and slum landlord. And so it just became a regular thing for me. And I was pretty much taken in by the movement. I was moved by the likes of Martin Luther King and moved by Malcolm X and Fannie Lou Hamer and Rosa Parks and many others, many local people. There was an organization called the Black United Front, and I used to sneak into those meetings with those guys, and I was learning all the time. People like Vernon Dobson, who was pastor of Union Baptist Church, and Perrin Mitchell, who was about to become a congressman, and we worked on his campaign where he was elected in 1970. So it's just always been around, Tom.
In 1970 is the year you went to college.
Right.
You went to Johns Hopkins, and you were part of the largest, to that point, the largest black contingent of students at Johns Hopkins. There were how many of you when you started?
We were recruited by a guy named Ron Owens, and he recruited 27 of us, of which 24 of us graduated. And we delivered a statement at graduation, which I worked with my classmates to to write and to organize, and we about what life was like at Johns Hopkins as black students. You know, how there was a need to increase the amount of black instructional and administrative staff, and to increase the course offerings. So there was a whole student movement too, which we were I was involved with in high school and in college. And so that was my my life at Johns Hopkins, which I returned there to work with a chaplain for a couple of years, as I, before that, had returned back to Loyola High School, and I taught there for 2 years.
That's Ralph Moore, an activist who's been active here in Baltimore, native of Sandtown, Winchester, and been at it ever since. DeRay McKesson, Black Lives Matter movement is, you know, famous for not having any central leadership, although your name has been associated with the movement for the past several years, ever since your appearance on the scene in Ferguson, Missouri. You were working in Minneapolis, in the school system in Minneapolis. Now you're here in Baltimore working in the school system here. Explain to us how you made that that drive from Minneapolis to Ferguson, and what was happening, and then how the movement sort of developed from that.
Yeah, so I think about, you know, I was born and raised here in Baltimore, grew up around Poplar Grove and Prestbury on the west side, and I was an organizer when I was a teenager here in the city, and worked in most of the nonprofits and supporting young people across the city as they develop programs in their own parts of the community. So that was really powerful. I went to college. I went to Bowdoin in Maine, which was great. And then I taught sixth grade math in East New York, Brooklyn. And that was really one of the first deep experiences with direct service and injustice. So I taught all black kids in one of the largest project communities in the country. And it was incredible to be a math teacher and to help kids see that they had gifts that they did not know that they had. And that was an incredible experience. I worked at the Harlem Children's Zone, one of the largest community centers in the country. I came back here, opened up one on the west side out of Ashburton. And then I managed the way we trained and supported a third of all the new teachers in the city. And then I started to work in the school system here. Dr. Alonzo left. I went to Minneapolis. And Mike Brown got killed on August 9th, 2014. I was sitting on my couch on August 16th, 2014. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. I saw what was happening on CNN, and I saw what was happening on Twitter, and they were telling two very different stories. And I said, I want to go. So I got in the car, drove 9 hours, didn't know anybody in the state of Missouri. I put a Facebook message up that said, if anybody knows anybody in St. Louis that I can sleep on their couch, let me know. I get a call 7 hours in when I'm in Iowa driving in the middle of the night. And they are like, we found somewhere for you to stay. And that was the beginning of it for me. So, you know, I have a big Twitter presence, and Twitter was really important as an organizing tool for us in St. Louis in those first 300 days of protest. And it really helped us organize. It helped us, you know, push back against a system that was repressing people. You think about Missouri, you know, unlike Baltimore. In Baltimore, people saw the aerial footage of the protest. In St. Louis, there was a no-fly zone immediately. When the protest began, most people also saw us out there marching, and they think that we marched in solidarity with the civil rights movement. It was illegal to stand still in those early months in St. Louis, so we had to march. It wasn't a choice. And I met so many incredible people, and what we saw was with the death of Mike Brown, so many communities across the country also came out in protest in Baltimore and Minneapolis and in so many cities across the country. People came out, and that spirit of unrest actually traveled much further than we thought, and it was sustained all across the community, all across the country. And that's what we've seen over the last 2 years, is people really focused on protest. When I think about protest, it's this idea of telling the truth in public, that is so much of what we do with our bodies, that is so much of what people continue to do. And I'm back at the school system for an interim period because I believe in Dr. Santelises, the superintendent, and I believe in kids and Baltimore's home. So I wanted to come help open up school in a strong way, and I think that we've done that.
What are your plans for the school system? I mean, you are the interim chief human capital officer. I mean, interim means how long?
You know,
have
we'll
you figured
see.
That out?
I know, but we will we will see.
But it's pretty short.
We'll see. I'm really proud of the stuff that we've gotten to do as the school year has begun. So we have the lowest number of vacancies since we've ever been able to record it, the lowest number of surplus. We are really proud of the caliber of teachers in the district, and I think Dr. Santelises has a really strong vision. So as human capital officer, some of the stuff that I do is make sure that we have great people working with our kids every day, and I'm proud of the foundation that we've had. And you know, a year ago, there was big negative news with the district around the first pay of the year, where there were all these people outside the building. Right. We had the best first pay we've ever had since we have been able to track it. So I'm really proud of how we've started the year. And I told Dr. Santelis when I came back that my commitment to her and to the school system was to help her have a great footing in human capital as she started, and to help find a real star to replace me to be the permanent human capital officer. And I think that we're on track.
Great.
So, Ralph Moore, what we want to talk about today is this lineage between the movement of the 60s to the movement of today. In a general way, what do you think that lineage entails? I mean, do you see a lot of similarities between the young people like DeRay working in the movement today and the young people who were working with you both in Baltimore and on the national scene in the 60s and 70s?
Well, when I think of similarities, I think of the fact that the civil rights movement, and everybody's got different opinions about it, but the civil rights movement probably was really focused and launched with the murder of Emmett Till in 1955. This is the kid from Chicago who went down to Money, Mississippi to visit and stay with his cousins and said something, whistled, whatever they're saying now, with a white woman in a small convenience store.
14 years old.
14 years old. He was a high school freshman. And he was killed. He was dragged from his uncle's bed in his house and assaulted and then thrown into the Tallahatchie River. And Rosa Parks will say that if you read her biographies and autobiographies, that's what helped get her focused and involved. And, of course, she trained at the Highlander Center in Newmarket, Tennessee, too. So that movement, that death of that young person launched that movement. And the Black Lives Matter movement, I would say, was launched first with the death of Trayvon Martin in 2012, and then with Michael Brown. Two young people. Trayvon Martin was 17. How old was Michael Brown? 18, I think.
18, yeah.
So young people. So there's a similarity there. And then the other similarity to me is that both movements are... even though there's some integration involved, but they're launched by African Americans in their form, both dealt with direct action as a tactic to bring attention to the issues, and both of them did have some concern. A greater emphasis in the Black Lives Matter movement, but Martin Luther King and Malcolm X both talked about police brutality 50 years ago. It was a great concern then, and it's still a great, great concern. So those are the things I see that are similar. And the children of the civil rights movement are now in the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think each generation becomes a bit more impatient and a bit more forceful. My parents were a little bit nervous about Martin Luther King and all the direct action and the sit-ins and all that kind of thing. I remember a neighbor coming to my mother and saying, "I'd like to take your boys with my son to the March on Washington." I was 11 years old at the time. And she said, no, there were a lot of people who were nervous about that. So I think the prevailing attitude then with a lot of people was, you know, that they were not a part of that movement, and it was outliers. It was people who were outsiders that pretty much launched that.
Sure.
But Martin Luther King, incidentally, made a statement about police brutality at that March on Washington.
Yeah.
I have the quote here somewhere, but he said something to the effect that we can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. That was in his eye of
And during McKesson, 50 years hence, we are still unsatisfied and still working for it. I mean, to what extent, we're going to take a little break and then we're going to take folks' calls and we're going to talk a lot more about this, but to what extent do you have the notion, the sense that Black Lives Matter is, you know, standing on the shoulders of the people who were active in the 50s and 60s in the South and throughout the country in the movement then?
Yeah, so we know that we didn't invent resistance and we didn't discover injustice, right? That we exist in a legacy of struggle. We know that. What is different is that we have, the movement was not born out of institutions. So you think about the role of churches and schools in the civil rights movement, very big presence, minimal presence today. We also just have access to different tools. So you think about the most eloquent
communication tools in particular.
Yep. So you think about King, you think about Malcolm, you think about Fannie Lou Hamer. They didn't have a mechanism to just talk to 100,000 people at the drop of a hat, and we do all of a sudden, whether it is Periscope, whether it's Twitter, whether it's Facebook Live, like the tools are just different, which allows for a different type of organizing. But I think the trauma is very similar, right? That like, I think of Black Lives Matter is born out of the death of Mike Brown, and it became a chant that then people across the country started saying, and people were in solidarity with the protests. I think that the death of Trayvon really helped people see injustice for the first time. And it wasn't something that was sort of this distant thing that our parents faced. It was something that all of a sudden we were like, wow, this actually is still happening. Yeah. Very viscerally. But I think that's been powerful. When you think about 2 years later, you know, people thought that St. Louis had a problem 2 years ago. They thought there was a problem in Ferguson. They did not say there was a problem across the country. And 2 years later, people have accepted and acknowledged that there's a problem. I think the next step is, how do we help people think about what it is to fix it? And with the Civil Rights Movement, there were these national, right? It was the Voting Rights Act. It was the Civil Rights Act. And what we found with the police is that there are 18,000 police departments. So this will be, a combination of local strategies. And how do we figure out the right places to press?
Yeah, DeRay McKesson is active in the Black Lives Matter movement. He's the interim chief human capital officer in the Baltimore City school system and the co-founder of Campaign Zero, which focuses on police reform. Ralph Moore joins me in the studio as well, longtime civil rights activist and the former program manager at Restoration Gardens. It's a residence for formerly homeless youth. They're going to be speaking tomorrow night at St. Bartholomew's Episcopal Church on the West Side in Baltimore in the second of three deliberations that explore the lineage of the civil rights movement and the Black Lives Matter movement. The third event in that series is a week from tomorrow, October 19th. You can join our conversation when we come back from a break. Give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can drop us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall or an email midday@wipr.org. More with Ralph Moore and DeRay McKesson after these words. Stick around. And welcome back. It's midday here on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Looking ahead on the program, the Baltimore Running Festival is this Saturday. More than 25,000 runners will take to the streets of Charm City, and when they're finished their 5K or their half marathon or their full marathon, they'll probably have an ache or two to contend with. So coming up on midday tomorrow, ways to avoid injury if you're one of those weekend warriors who hits the road or the basketball court or the soccer field. Dr. Miho Tanaka is the director of the Women's Sports Medicine Center at Johns Hopkins Hospital, and we'll talk about running and exercise and staying pain-free. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about the resonance of the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s for the Black Lives Matter movement. DeRay McKesson and Ralph Moore join me in the studio. DeRay has been active with Black Lives Matter, and Ralph, who was born in Sandtown, Winchester, is a longtime activist in Baltimore. He's won numerous awards, including the Baltimore NAACP's 100th Anniversary Thurgood Marshall Award in 2012. We'd love to have you be part of the conversation this afternoon. You can give us a call, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or send us a tweet, our handle, @MiddayTomHall. 410-662-8780 if you want to call. So, DeRay, the fact that Black Lives Matter is purposefully organized without a central figure. I mean, there are people who've tried to establish you as the central figure of Black Lives Matter, or perhaps three of the other folks who are credited with coining the phrase, at least, Patrice Cullors and Opal Temeti, along with Alicia Garza. What's the advantage of not having a central figure the way that in the 60s we had Dr. King?
Yeah, I think that there are people leading at every level, at the local, state, the national level, and that is important. What we've also seen is that people have found their voice and have found different styles of leadership, and we want to validate all of those. So I think about in cities across the country, I've seen people have different strategies. I think the context of a protest is very different, and we validate that. And we don't want to create a situation where it's kill the leader, kill the movement, that if people disappear tomorrow, if people just want to step back in the movement space, that people should still be able to organize, and like that should be real. So I do think there are some particular challenges of a decentralized space. I think that also there's some challenges of a space without institutions, right? Like I think that, you know, when there's conflict in the movement, there's no mediator, you know, in a space without traditional structures. And I think that we're trying to,
I mean, the way that the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had the church, for example.
Right.
Or even nonviolent coordinating committee
had schools.
Schools, right.
Mm-hmm. So I think that that is particularly hard. I think that there are questions around like what are who is signing on to a set of goals and statements and beliefs. I think that that is like that poses a real challenge for some people. But I also have seen the real benefit of so many people having a home in the movement and being able to align with the principles and the cause at a macro level. And I think that over the next couple months, the next year, we need to figure out how to refine that, because I do think we have a critical mass of people who acknowledge there's a problem, and we have a critical mass of people who are ready to do something. And what most people don't remember about the civil rights movement, it was a decade, right? It wasn't like 2 years worth of people out in the street. It was a sustained space. And I say that to say that I think that the movement today is young, and that we'll continue to see it grow.
So when you say that people recognize that there is a problem, you mean structural problem with the way Black Lives Matter is operating? I mean, feel that the effectiveness is attenuated?
Problem. I think people acknowledge that there are some, you know, with everything, there are some strengths and weaknesses. And I think that some of the opportunities for growth around the decentralized space are, I think there's some questions about how do we align around goals that people can publicly acknowledge, and what does it mean to sign on? I think there's some questions about how do we deal with conflict? What does it mean to support people locally and nationally? I think that those questions are easier when there's like just a structure. Mm-hmm. But we've seen a lot of benefits otherwise.
Sure. And I also think it might be a little bit harder to connect to the movement without the focus and to strategize, I think. I mean, one of the things
without a leader, you mean.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that the civil rights movement could do and King could do is he could step back and look at the map. Where do we need to be now? And, you know, if he decided to go to Alabama, he would do that. If he decided to go to Cicero outside Chicago, he would do that. But he was a very strategic organizer, depending on what issues they wanted to deal with, whether it was trying to pass the Civil Rights Act or whether they were trying to deal with the issue of poverty. You know, because King was certainly interested in organizing around the issue of the elimination of poverty. And so I think there are benefits to sort of having a more diffuse leadership. On the other hand, like as you're saying, I think that there could, there could be some greater benefit with a little bit more focus of and it doesn't have to be a single person. It seems to me that if you had a males and females, if you had people of different stripes or a committee that had a higher profile, that could be beneficial.
410-662-8780 to join our conversation with Ralph Moore and DeRay McKesson here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org, or a tweet @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones. Kim from Baltimore is on the line. Kim, welcome to Midday.
Hi. As an old school organizer in the 80s and 90s, I just got to thank DeRay. I saw him at a Stoop story a few years ago, and he got me on Twitter. So, but my question is, how through social media, I guess to what Ralph was saying, the committees and kind of the structure you need to move people into political action and such, how do you create that structure on social media? Because I see a lot of Facebook pages around policy and politics and such, and there's a lot of people who've never been in the field who are kind of considered experts about this stuff. So, you know, who do you know who your leaders are and who to listen to?
Yeah, so, DeRay, I mean, the social media has certainly allowed this to be a national movement. Perhaps the kinds of things you're talking about, Ralph, weren't possible in the 1960s simply because we couldn't organize multiple fronts. BLM certainly has been able to organize in many different places.
Yeah, so I think you know a real challenge that many people have asked about. I think that one thing that I'm mindful of is that we have just gotten to a point where there's widespread consensus in the public that there's a problem. Again, I would say that like even when Walter Scott got killed, Sandra Bland, Freddie Gray, people were still sort of hemming and hawing and saying these are like special circumstances. They weren't like, okay, there's like just a structural problem with safety and policing. And now we've gotten to that point. I think that what we'll see over the next year is we will see groups come together and coalesce in what might seem like more traditional structures around like, here's the game plan, here's a strategy. I will say, and I think that Ralph raises a concern, I think the response to it would be that one of the things that we want to do is create a new critical mass. This is not just about creating like a new type of leader, like a new leadership class, but this is about how do we empower as many people and equip as many people with the skills to change their communities and change the central structure. I don't think like a chapter-based or member-based way of organizing is going to be what gets us there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the chapter-based, member-based ways of organizing is like the traditional sort of make a 501c3, get some members, apply. Like, I don't know if that's going to be the way. But like you know, I think that social media could allow us to continue to build connections and this idea of shared sense of goals. And I think that we're just at the beginning of trying to figure it out. We're going to launch something soon that I think hopes to get there. But people ask me all the time, what can I read? What can I do? And I think the movement does not yet have like a great way to respond to that. But there are so many people all across the country, across the city, who like are ready to do something. And the question now is like, how do we tap into that at scale?
On 88.1, it's Midday. That's DeRay McKesson joins us in the studio with Ralph Moore. I'm Tom Hall. To join the conversation, you can give us a call, 410-662-8780. We're going to go to Gaithersburg. Dennis is on the line. Welcome to Midday, Dennis.
Thank you. Again, I'm calling. One of the things you were talking about, this aspect of leadership, my comment had to do with Dr. King. When Dr. King was assassinated, the whole movement, to a certain degree, disintegrated. And I think your comment about distributed leadership is vital. That's a number of people who are speaking really the same thing, having one voice, but they are scattered so that, you know, you can't just target one person, take that person out, and then the movement is just disintegrated again. By having a group of people like what you have today, you're in a, you know, when you look at groups forming, you're in a move where there is forming. And that means it seems like there's no real structure, in my estimation, again. But and then it moves to forming. And you're in that place where you're forming. That means you're working out ideas, you're trying ideas. And from what I've seen on television, haven't been to a march or anything like that. I'm 64 years old, but I've been watching this for a period of time. You're doing exactly what is right. I appreciate what the young man said. I don't know if I get his name right, but I know it's like D-E-E-R-A-Y. I've watched him
pretty close.
Move from place to place, and it's been some powerful things that he's been involved with. I appreciate what he's doing.
All right. Well, Dennis, thank you so much for your call. So, Ralph, I mean, you were 18 years old in college 2 years after Dr. King was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And as DeRay says, you know, kill the leader, kill the movement. I mean, by the mid-1970s, I mean, Mrs. Parks got on that bus in Montgomery in 1955.
Right.
By 1975, it was a very different scene, wasn't it, in terms of the movement?
Well, yeah, a lot of things had changed in terms of the whole political structure. You know, we got Richard Nixon elected in 1968. He had a vast impact on the movement. He's the one who started the war on drugs, and also which ended up being a war on poor people, poor black people, and it gave way to the great militarization of the police departments. You know, where they got heavier equipment, got more heavy-handed, and conducted in city neighborhoods a war in which poor people and people of color were treated like enemy combatants. And that's what the Black Lives Matter movement is focused on and stopping and all. So a lot of life had changed. Now, I think I've participated in a lot of conversations about race relations, and people are very interested in talking about this. And the challenge is, how do we move people to action? You know, one of the dangers of the social media is that people think they're acting if they're spending time reading stuff and liking stuff and all that. And we've got to get people to go down to Annapolis in this area, for example, when in this upcoming session they bring up bills and have hearings about the relationship between the police and the community, the police union and the community, and how people can get involved. If there are issues regarding in the city council, there's an issue that's going to come up again about the $15 an hour minimum wage. People need to go there and call and write and even sit in if they need to get their city council to pass that.
But yeah, we've got to move physical manifestation of action.
We've got to move people action. To action, yeah. Concrete action.
Dre, you got 300,000 followers or something like that on 500. Twitter. 500,000. Okay, well, it's really? Gone up in the last 20 minutes, right?
Yeah, right.
But you know, so you can communicate with 500,000 people at the press of a button. But those aren't 500,000 actual people. Those are 500,000 cyber people, if you will. Now, they are actual people behind those addresses. But, I mean, is that a danger? Glazier, that the personal relationships that were developed when people were actually on the Pettus Bridge, when they were, you know, boycotting the buses in Montgomery, when they were on at the March on Washington. Is there enough of that going on, the physical manifestation of action?
I think we have to make sure that the movement grows as people grow. And, you know, there are many ways that you can take action. It doesn't all, and I say this as somebody who's been in the street in many cities across the country, that that is not the only way that you can be an activist. And we need to validate many ways of people participating. I think about so many people who have contributed digitally, who have helped organize digital campaigns to call in or, like, you know, to write letters. And I think that one of the things that the organizing community does that I think is really dangerous is says, if you don't organize like me, you're not an organizer. And I think that that is not a new thing. I think that that has been around for a while. I think that one of the questions for us is, how do we continue to mobilize people around these concrete actions that Ralph is talking about and using many different ways to do it? So I think about, you know, there was a call campaign that activists set up where you could call one phone number, put your zip code in, and it would automatically dial your, like, elected official's phone number, right? Simple to do, didn't take a lot of energy on the person to call, but, like, we were able to mobilize thousands of people to do it. And I think that we'll continue to see technology, social media, those sort of things help people take action in a different sort of way that isn't only showing up physically at Annapolis, but how do you put pressure on your legislators in Annapolis? It doesn't necessarily need to be at their office, but that can be somewhere else. I think that we've seen some incredible organizers around the country really press systems and structures in innovative ways, whether that's like shutting down a street, being in meetings, like proposing legislation. And I think we'll see a multitude of strategies.
410-662-8780. Email midday at WIPR. You can send us a tweet at midday Tom Hall. Justin has been patient, along with a few other folks, waiting on the line from Baltimore. Justin, you're an activist. What's your take on the Black Lives Matter movement here in Charm City?
Well, I wanted to ask a question specifically about the visibility of Black Lives Matter and its presence in Baltimore. As you said, I'm an activist, educator, and artist in Baltimore. And for me, when I search social media, I'm very savvy with social media. When I search it, I don't really see or feel a presence of Black Lives Matter here in the city specifically. And that bothers me, being as though we kind of are a catalyst, especially with the Freddie Gray death and murder, in my opinion. But with that, I feel like we should definitely have a presence or a hold and be looked at as a place where this would be centralized. And I'm wondering, from D-Ray and from the others, what are some of the obstacles keeping that from happening? I've been to Beautiful Struggle. I've gone to some of these meetings, and I appreciate them, but I don't see Black Lives Matter centralized in Baltimore the way that I expected it would be or should be at this point.
Yeah, so there is no, like, central, there isn't, like, one thing that gets to say that it is Black Lives Matter. I think one of the beauties of the movement is that that many people have aligned with the phrase and have started to organize, and there are some incredible organizers that were in the city before that continue to be in the city. I think that some of the work of organizing is, like, the not glamorous, like, sitting down and talking about what you want the city to look like, and it's those sort of that sort of grassroots type of organizing. And I think that there's still space for people like you to get people together and say, like, you know, I want to start organizing, that you don't have to join a group, you don't have to join a set of people who have been organizing before, that you can actually start to do this. And I do think that you know, one of the things after the murder of Freddie Gray and the protests that ensued is that I think that there were so many people that were looking for something to do and a space to go, and I don't know if they found that space. I've been to a lot of cities across the country where after the huge uprisings, like, people take it upon themselves to, like, create these big community forums, essentially, where people just come and talk and build a different type of network. And I think that here, that sort of happened to a capacity, didn't happen to some capacity, but I still think that there's so many people who, like, want to do good work. I think also we had the election come up, and that sort of, like, shifted some of the energy in the city around what solutions look like, that, like, for all of the energy that came from the unrest, that then the election swooped and, like, the news cycle just changed here in the city. But I think the people remain. I think you're a testament to that. There's so many people who are still hungry for a different way of organizing. And I do think that as we transition to the end of this calendar year and into the beginning, I'm hopeful that there'll be more people coming together to form new organizing spaces.
DeRay McKesson and Ralph Moore will be speaking tomorrow night at St. Bartholomew's Episcopal Church in the second of three deliberations under the rubric From Martin Luther King Jr. to Black Lives Matter. The third panel in the series will take place at St. Bartholomew's on October 19th. It will include Karen Stokes, Christopher Burnett, Michael Haney, and the Reverend Dr. Angela Shepherd. By the way, coming up later this month on October 24th, National NAACP President Cornell William Brooks will talk about the Black Lives Matter movement at McDaniel College, and we'll have a link to both of those events on our website, wypr.org/midday. You can link up with us this afternoon. When we come back from a break, we'll take your calls and comments, 410-662-8780. Email midday@wypr.org or send us a tweet at midday Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. Lots more coming up.
I tell you, I feel like singing the song, a Haley Jackson song at the March on Washington over 50 years ago, how we got over, how we got over. There was some who said, it couldn't happen. Who said, you can't do it, but we did it, we did it.
Congressman John Lewis speaking at the opening of the new National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington just a couple of weeks ago. He's, of course, one of the co-founders of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and a close ally of Dr. Martin Luther King. Today on Midday, we're talking about the connections between the Black Lives Matter movement and the civil rights struggles of the 1960s. My guests are Ralph Moore, the former program manager at Restoration Gardens, a residence for formerly homeless youth. He also was formerly a coordinator of mentoring at the Mentoring Academy in Baltimore, a program of the Living Questions Foundation. DeRay McKesson is here as well. He's active in the Black Lives Matter movement. He's the interim chief human capital officer in the Baltimore City Public School System and the co-founder of Campaign Zero. You can join our conversation. Give us a buzz, 410-662-8780. Send us an email, midday@wypr.org, or a tweet, @midday Tom Hall. So, Ralph Moore, let's talk about politics. That's something DeRay knows a little bit about as a former candidate for mayor. We have a guy like John Lewis who made the move from activism to politics. And there, he's not the only one. I mean, I think of people like Andrew Young or Julian Bond, other people like that.
And Jesse Jackson tried.
Jesse Jackson ran for president, you know, won seven primaries the first time he ran for president. Do you see the Black Lives Matter movement from your perch as a veteran of the movement? Do you see the Black Lives Matter movement as a place, a farm system for you know, cultivating young talent like DeRay McKesson to run for office?
I hope so. I mean, I think it was a great move on his part to run for mayor. I mean, it was late, you know, just a lot of things. But I think that arena needs to be occupied by people who have the heart and the brains to deal with the issues. And so, I mean, we can't write that off. You know, we need elected officials who care and who are able to listen and to move and act. So yeah, I would encourage it. I think it's a good thing. And as long as folks keep in touch, it's not always either or. Sometimes it's both and. You know, one of the nicest things I observed, and maybe you all did too, was when the members of Congress sat down in the House of Representatives to get the rest of the Congress to focus in on the gun control issue. Now, yeah, it's not always about sitting in. There's a variety of strategies, and we need to draw from them. And there needs to be more of a dialogue, a conversation between those of us who might be considered old school and those who are very active and younger in the Black Lives Matter movement. I think there needs to be some remembering, some mentoring, some exchange, some critique of the past as well as the present. And so that's one of the things I would hope would happen. In addition to people getting into elective office, that there'd be more of a dialogue, more of a mentoring, more of an exchange between the old school and the The Young Turks, we used to call them.
And DeRay, your candidacy for mayor was thought by many, including me, to be very thoughtful, to be very policy-driven, to be very thorough in your understanding of what was going on, what is going on in the city, and your solutions to that. But the Black Lives Matter movement has, or at least many people have described it as an apolitical movement, that politics are really a side thing. They are an equal opportunity protester. They've disrupted Bernie Sanders rallies and Trump rallies and Clinton rallies. Tomorrow is Yom Kippur. Jews around the world will celebrate Yom Kippur, and there's not a small amount of controversy about statements and platforms issued by the Black Lives Matter movement about Israel and the state of Israel and its relationship to the Palestinians. Is it a tough line to walk and to traverse in terms of staying non-political, but also being part of the political discussion?
Yeah, I think that the movement, you know, protest is political, right? Protest is politics. There is no transition from protest to politics. It is a political act. It is about saying that the distribution of power should look different, that people should use power differently. The platform that you spoke about does not represent the movement. It represents, like, some people within the space. But, for example, me, it's not something that I agree with, that platform, and have signed on to. But I do think that, like Ralph said, we have to be as organized on the inside as we are on the outside. That has to be a part of the strategy. That an outside-only strategy is a strategy to fight forever. It's not a strategy to win. That we need people in the city councils and the mayor's office and the Senate and the House and Congress and the White House. That people have to be the people, like, actually making the way that we administer the laws, like the regulate, like that has to be a part of how we think about the fight. I'm a systems person. I mean, it's like why I work in the school. It's why I've worked in the school system in my career, because I believe that we can fundamentally change systems and structures in ways that change culture to have a better impact on people's lives. And that has to be a part of the strategy.
Speaking of that, here's an email from Olivia, and she writes, "What do you see as the future of organizing through social media and technology when the government seems to have limitless access to and control of all of our internet-based communications?" She writes that I was in Charlotte and Facebook cut off our ability to live stream at points when she was in Charlotte as part of the protest. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that we've never seen that sort of behavior come from Twitter. Facebook has some challenges with that, but I think Twitter with Periscope and the tweets have been pretty open about the communication side. I think that one of the beautiful things about social media is that all of it happens in public. So when Facebook is cutting down feeds and things like that, we are able to push back and we're able to, like, have that be a visible part of the conversation. But I'm hopeful, because the reality is, like, we're not asking for anything that people don't deserve, right? And having these conversations in public has helped create a different type of critical mass around these issues. And I think that people want to do good work, that there are people who benefit from the status quo who will always reinforce it. But what we've seen over the last 2 years in protests is that there's so many people who are ready for something different. They don't know how to go about it potentially, but they're ready.
Let's try to get to the phones, take a couple more calls before we finish up today. Clarence, you're calling us from Woodlawn. Welcome to Midday. Glad to have you. So, Clarence, you should turn your radio down. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, what's on your mind? I appreciate your patience waiting today.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate the work that your panel has done, but I wanted to ask, recently there's been some UN discussion regarding reparations, which was promised but was never kept. My question is, some people think it's because some of the technicalities within the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments as it pertains to African Americans who were former slaves. I want to know if the real problem is not, picketing in the streets regarding social change that's been done since the inception of this country. And honestly, there's more blacks in prison now than there were slaves during that time. So we know that that does not work. So my question to you is, the problem the verbiage in the Constitution? I mean, the right to vote. Our right to vote has to go before Congress after every 7 or 14 years, I think, can recall exactly, whether we can even vote or not. That's not even a permanent thing. So I'm wondering if the actions of America has made it plain how it views African Americans who are from slavery descent, and which is actually manifested in laws, Jim Crow laws, even, you know, laws even today, which are disproportionately,
sure,
you know.
Yeah, Ralph Moore, a couple of things that Clarence said. We do have the right to vote, and that doesn't have to be renewed every 7 years. I'm pretty sure that that's not in dispute, and I'm not sure that reparations were ever promised. This was something, of course, that this is something that's been on people's minds for quite a while.
Yeah, he also said picketing doesn't work, and I would wholeheartedly disagree with that, certainly. Well, I think that there ought to be reparations, and I think it ought to be figured out. Georgetown University just announced a program to deal with the descendants of slaves. That it was, I think, a couple of hundred of them, close to 300 of them, that they sold in order to be able to keep the university solvent and all. And they found those people, and they promised them that they would have a special status in terms of admissions, although they ought to give them tuition free. Actually, the Jesuits, my Jesuit friends ought to hear that. But there ought to be reparations, more and more reparations for African Americans. We've given some reparations to the Japanese who were interred in concentration camps during World War II. I think Native American communities have gotten reparations. And so it's time that African Americans get reparations too. We endured 400 years of slavery. We endured, 100 years of segregation, legal segregation, 50 years maybe. Of course, there's been mass poverty and mass incarceration. So a lot of pain has been visited on the African-American community, and we're stuck, a lot of us, not all of us, Donald Trump, but a lot of us are still stuck in poverty, and we need some acknowledgement from the government and some assistance from the government to end, because we built the situation that we're in now. We need to with reparations and other things, to dismantle it.
Let me take one more call as we finish up here. Victor, you're on the line from Washington. Thanks for joining Midday.
Hi. I just want to say, I don't want to get into the whole reparations thing because I'm against it. I'm a black man in my mid-50s. I feel like this is my country, and reparations to me represents somebody paying you for something that you did for them. And this is, I don't want reparations. But I wanted to say that before today, I thought of Black Lives Matter as some group that was kind of angry and wanted to bully the system, the political system and all that. I wasn't aware that Black Lives Matter was so involved in and new history and stuff like that. So I appreciate this program and its format, and I'll take a better look at the organization after today.
Well, I'm glad you listened, and I'm glad that that's the case. Deray McKesson, we just have a couple seconds left here. The importance of public support for Black Lives Matter and the success of the movement.
Yep. So remember, with that last caller, there's no one organization that leads the movement, but I'm happy that you have a renewed sense of faith in the movement. With reparations, remember, it's also this idea of acknowledge and repair, that we acknowledge the past and the wrongdoings and we need to repair them. The movement is young. I'm excited that there's so many people who are ready to do things to fix the structural inequities, and I think we're going to do it.
All right. Well, thanks to you both, Ralph Moore and Deray McKesson. I really appreciate you guys coming by. We had a nice conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Ralph Moore is a longtime civil rights activist and former program manager at Restoration Gardens, a residence for formerly homeless youth. Deray McKesson is active in the Black Lives Matter movement. He's the interim chief human capital officer in the Baltimore City Public School System and the co-founder of Campaign Zero, policy plan for police reform. They'll be speaking tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at St. Bartholomew's Episcopal Church as part of a series of panels entitled From Martin Luther King Jr. to Black Lives Matter. We've got the details about that panel tomorrow and all the rest of them on our website. You can come on over to WIPR.org/midday. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, Dr. Miho Tanaka. She's the director of the Johns Hopkins Women's Sports Program, and she'll be here to talk about how to avoid injuries from exercise and what to think about when you're planning an exercise regimen. That's tomorrow on Midday in advance of the Baltimore Running Festival this weekend, and good luck to everybody who is running the marathon or the half marathon or the 5K on Saturday. We also want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us for this Tuesday edition of Midday. Thanks for your calls and comments. We'll talk more tomorrow. Have a great day.